You're listening to Radio Primavera Sound, proudly presented by Cupra.
Welcome to an RPS presentation of an interview with Franklin James Fisher, lead singer and musician in Algiers. The transatlantic band formed in Atlanta have recently published Shook, a creatively triumphant record where they continue to experiment with different sounds and textures, inspired greatly by early hip-hop recordings. The record features a wide array of guest collaborators, including Rage Against the Machine's Zach De La Rocha and Future Islands' Sam T. Herring. We caught up with Franklin over the Zoom line to talk about the making of Shook, among other things. Hi, Franklin. Thank you for joining us. Shook is an album recorded with many collaborators. First of all, let's talk about the title. Shook is a reference to how the band felt after years of creating this band. What led to this collective feeling of being shocked?
Yeah, it's just, it's not specific to the band. It's just the past couple of years have been pretty traumatic for most people in some fashion or other. And it's just describing how that feels. How the past couple of years been for you?
Let's just say it's been an interesting time. Back when you were promoting your previous album, The Underside of Power, in 2017, you spoke of the harsh reality of what it's like trying to be a band and make a record in 2017. You were also apparently on the verge of splitting up. How did you manage to navigate the low moments and keep it together?
I think, honestly, the pandemic just enabled us to stop. And you know, in that respect, it was, you know, when quarantine started, it was for the first time we each had our own space, you know, because when you're on the road, you're constantly sharing the hotel room with at least one other guy. We didn't have to worry about money because there was unemployment insurance and things like from the federal government. And, you know, so it's like our quality of life increased like tenfold, you know. Because, you know, when we were on the road prior to that, I hadn't had an apartment in 3 years because it just didn't make sense because I was never home. You know, it doesn't make sense paying New York City rent if you're never home. So, you know, I think in 2018, I think we played like 250 shows in a year, you know, and it was just, you know, it's exhausting. And especially if you're not a particularly, you know, well-known band like ours, you know, it's not like we're Queens of the Stone Age or something like that. So you're out there and it's excruciatingly defeating sometimes. It's tiring. But COVID came along and we were able to just finally just have some semblance of a life for the first time in a long time. And we started just making music for the fun of it again. Because ironically, when you're a touring musician, making music, writing music is like one of the last things you get to do, if at all. You know? So we got to just get back to making music for the fun of it and with no particular intention of making a record or anything like that. But this grew out of that. You know?
Uh-huh. This album is kind of a love letter to underground and fundamental hip-hop. Cleanse Your Guilt here sounds like a song produced by RZA, for instance. How did the creative process for this record begin?
It was, so we started our tour for the last record and we were 5 dates into it when quarantine happened. And we just so happened to be in Atlanta where we're all from. That was just like serendipitous, you know? And so we all wound up quarantining at Ryan's cousin's house. And we all just occupied his house for the next 2 months. And at this time, nobody knew what was going to happen. You know, it was the beginning of COVID. So we got enough alcohol for, you know, a small city. And, you know, we went to the grocery store and his cousin had a grill. And we just kind of partied, you know, because kind of expecting like the zombie apocalypse or whatever. And Ryan and I, when we first met, we bonded over our love of rap and similar artists and things like this. And so we wound up watching a lot of just YouTube while we're partying and just hanging out and Rap City and like all this old school hip hop and stuff like that. And just bonding over stuff that made us excited, just music that made us excited when we were kids, you know, just being able to do it again. So like a lot of it just came out of that, you know. We wound up kind of using the time to try to get better at certain things, programming or what have you. So Ron and I both wound up making a couple of beats a day and just having fun with it, you know, watching these old school videos of like, you know, Kanye West, rest in peace, you know, like when he was in the studio, like kind of shit up, and it was amazing, you know, and just getting involved in all of that. It was really just playing and having fun.
Did you already have the equipment for sampling and looping, or was it acquiring different music making gadgets a new adventure in itself?
We already had, like, I already had the SP-404 because I've been touring with that for a long time, and that's what I primarily use. But there was some new equipment, you know. Ryan and Lee bought an old school Akai MPC 2000 years ago, and it just kind of sat in the storage space in London. And I know that they got that out right before quarantine happened, and Ryan and Lee started messing with that a lot. And they wound up doing a record called, they did two records. Ryan did a solo record called Dead Meat. And then they had another, like a collaboration called Mondo Decay. And it was like a soundtrack thing. They took old school Italian horror and they manipulated it at half speed with tape loops and all these things. But I think they also used the NPC and some of this new gear to that effect, you know. And both of those projects kind of refined certain techniques that Ryan and Liam respectively been pursuing, and then they brought that into this record, and you know, that's really apparent with certain tracks, you know, like that song Something Wrong.
How did Algiers evolve once you brought Matt Tong, who apart from being a very gifted drummer is also an academically trained musician, how did you evolve once you brought him into the fold? I'm imagining that having a fourth member brought an extra dynamic to the band. Is that so?
Yeah, man. Yeah, I think so. I think bands are all about energy, really. And it's about how you manipulate that energy together and how you create something with those energies. And certainly with us, that's where Algiers exists, in a live space. And Matt Tong has such explosive energy. He just helps to bring exponentially more to what's already in the pot, and it blossoms into this incredible live kind of experience, you know. That first Block Party record, you know, Silent Alarm, that's all about energy. You know, it's infectious, which they obviously lost when Matt and Gordon left, I suppose. But yeah, it's a good question.
You've spoken in the past about this being a band made up of nerds and how you've had to negotiate with each other to include ideas in songs. That sounds very exhausting. Is that still the case? I mean, do you debate a lot?
Not necessarily every creative decision, but yeah, everything is a constant negotiation, you know. It's just, which plays into a lot of our strengths and maybe some of our faults as well. But we're very democratic in that way, you know. Creatively, it's not as strictly adherent to that. You know, I just think if there's a good idea, particularly if somebody's written a good song, then you want to do what's best for the song. Let the song determine what it wants to be, you know. And you have to have a lot of trust in order to do that. And you have to you can't have such an ego if you want to really trust the process and trust that others might have better ideas at some point. It's a dance, you know.
Once a group of individuals have been working together for many years, does that get easier? Because you can almost guess what the others are thinking, or does it get worse? Like, do you become more confident in the process of making art together?
It's a good question. I wrote the majority of this record. And as I was writing the demos for these songs, one thing I wanted to do was to carve out space. So I would write the song, but try to leave space for everybody to do what he does respectively in the band in order to fill it out, you know?
Uh-huh.
You know, because of what you said, you start to anticipate what others will do, and you want to leave everybody enough room to operate autonomously within the song, you know? But funny enough, I did that, and a lot of that, Lee he wound up just leaving that space there because he liked the ambiance that it created, but the absence of what he would have done, you know? And that's always kind of how it works. It's creatively, it's this very strange tug of war, but it has interesting results. You know, it's cool to be able to collaborate with people at that level after so long. You know, you develop layers of that relationship, and then your work becomes richer for it, I think.
How did working with Adrian Utley from Portishead on your previous album influence you as producers?
Well, I can't speak for everybody because we all have such different experiences every time in the studio. But that was the first time I understood the difference between a producer and an engineer was when we were recording with Adrian and Ali. And yeah, I think just having a keener understanding of that differentiation, you know, it just kind of helped me understand how to be better prepared when you go into the studio, you know, and to understand what is required of you when you go in as opposed to what you might have thought. You know, it's a very boring answer, but it wound up being really practical. It was a great learning process with Adrian, you know.
Let's talk about the guest collaborators. The guest list on Shook is breathtaking. I mean, what an incredible lineup of featured artists, starting with Zach De La Rocha. I mean, this guy doesn't get out of bed for just anyone. I mean, it's Zach De La Rocha, for God's sakes. First of all, what's your first memory of listening to Rage Against the Machine for the first time?
Man, I don't think I understood it the first time I heard it. You know, mm-hmm. I that energy hadn't really been captured before on record that I'd heard. And you know, I was a teenager when Rage Against the Machine were in their heyday, and so like I hadn't really developed that complex of like a political awareness until I got to college a couple of years later. So I didn't really understand what they were addressing, but it was really interesting and really cool to try to understand it. You know, it had a like an aura around it. I think Zach still has an aura around him, you know.
And how did you establish that connection to get him to feature in Shook?
Our friend Sohail, he's a professor of film, and he directed our video Dispossession from the last record. Sohail and Zach grew up together in LA, and I they're super close. And Sohail brought him to one of our gigs back in like 2016. That's when we met him. Yeah. I don't know. I figured at some point, and I can't tell you exactly when, it became a collective decision to just embrace the our community of friends and collaborators at that time where everybody was sort of atomized, you know. And I don't know exactly when that came about, but it became a conscious decision. It's like, oh, it'll be cool. Like, nobody's doing anything anyway, you know, like, and so we asked if Zach would be interested in getting on a track, you know? And it's like, yeah, send me some stuff. So we sent him a couple of tracks, and Irreversible Damage is the one that he chose, and the verse that he wrote for it, it's amazing because it sounds like the song was written around it, you know? So that's just, that lets you just know how incredible of an artist he is.
Irreversible Damage even has a trap beat, a genre that is synonymous with Atlanta, I guess. Was there a creative discussion about that part of the song in the sense of playing with stereotypes of what a band that is partly Atlantan should do as a nod to the local sound?
I mean, we were, you know, like I said earlier, like I Ryan and I got very heavy back into hip hop over that period. And when I don't know. I it must have been somewhat unconscious being in Atlanta, re-engaging all of the culture, but also listening to a lot of hip hop again. And you know, I was making several beats a day. And when I wrote Irreversible, it was just, you know, the song is just about pure anxiety and getting that anxiety fed back at you when you engage media. Especially when nobody knows what the hell's going on, just like that just sounded like anxiety to me, you know. That's how it came out. But yeah, it's definitely got some trap vibes to it. There's an 808 for sure, you know. There's that all over the record, you know, that stuttering hi-hat, you know. Atlanta definitely seeped into this record in a lot of unconscious ways. So that's an interesting observation.
Yeah, because I don't recall ever hearing that sort of beat on a previous Algiers album.
That's the thing, right? It's like that exact same drum machine is used on Irony Utility Pretext, which is also like a reference to like Planet Rock by Afrika Bambaataa, you know? It's also the same drum machine that I programmed Cleveland with on Other Side of Power, you know? Like also same drum machines on the first record with But She Was Not Flying, you know? And it's like, these elements have always been there. But for whatever reason, I think people just haven't necessarily noticed as much the way that hip hop informs our DNA, you know? But it's not really that much of a departure from anything that we've done before. There's just more focus on it, I suppose, in an aesthetic sense, because that's what we were listening to at the time when we were back home, like you said.
Both you and Sam T. Herring from Future Islands share a quality for soul singing that has stood both Algiers and Future Islands out in alternative rock. How did this duet for I Can't Stand It come about? Were you friends from before, or was it a cold knock at the door?
No, we were friends from before. I met Future Islands when we were making our first record. The Beggars Group office in London has apartments. They have flats above the office for like touring artists or whatever to stay in. And when we made our first record, Ryan and Lee were both living in London. And so I came over and we recorded at the 4 Radio Studio, which is next door. We recorded our first record there. And it took 6 months. So I was just staying in that flat for 6 months. And bands would come and go. You know, I remember Grimes the shit was all over the place. Like there were all these boxes for Claire Boucher or whatever. And Future Islands came through a couple of times because this was right after their big breakthrough. This was... what's the name of that record with Seasons? You know what I'm talking about. Yeah. And I remember I was, it was late and they had gotten back. Everybody had been drinking, you know. I was listening to music in my room. Sam comes through and we kind of shoot the shit. We have like a beer, whatever. And I'm listening to hip hop and then Sam starts rapping. And like freestyling, and he's like really good. And I'm like, what the fuck? It was cool, man. And so that was our first like couple of encounters. And also our friend Matt Rakini, who co-produced and engineered this record, he is their sound engineer. And so we first met Matt when we first started touring. And he was, you know, he's done sound for us on a handful of tours, but he was a huge part of this record, and we recorded a lot of it at his studio, at his house. And he is usually on the road with Future Islands. And yeah, we thought it might be a good idea to incorporate Sam because he was just kind of there because it's part of Matt's world. He was part of our world. You know? It's pretty organic. You know?
I've heard about the legend of Sam's skills as an MC, but I feel audiences wouldn't allow him to change register. It's like once you become known for a style of making art, people expect you to stay in your lane. And if you dare break out, you have all this backlash.
I feel like people are always like that. And then in retrospect, they're like, oh, that was amazing. But people never want the change when it happens. People didn't want the Beatles to change. Do you know what I mean? So it's always kind of fun to me when an artist does that, because that's kind of, it lets you know when somebody's real, you know, if they have like a creative curiosity that they want to explore, or if they're just doing it to get dollars, whatever the fuck. Yeah.
Did it feel liberating to work with other artists and not have the total pressure of finishing a song on your own?
Well, it was definitely liberating, but not because the songs weren't finished. You know, it was like I was telling you earlier about the dynamic of leaving space in order for the other guys in the band to do their thing. It was the same with bringing in the collaborators, you know. So it's like with any relationship, you know, you don't get into a relationship because you're not complete. It's not because you need somebody to complete you. It's because they'll complement what's already going on. You know what I mean? And it was cool because the answer is yeah, like definitely. On our last record, on There Is No Year, we wanted a plurality of voices, a lot of our friends, just to have some semblance of community and a group and inclusivity, and like you're a part of something. I also just get tired of hearing like 800 versions of myself singing back at me in every song. It's just like there's more interesting things to do after a while, you know. And but our two friends who produced our last record, they did not want to do that, and so it wound up being something very different. And it was exactly just 8,000 versions of Franklin singing at you. And so for any other reason, it was cool just because like the record's about everybody's personal experience and maybe like just the individual traumas or whatever. And when you allow that space for the guests to come in and sing their experiences or whatever, it inherently turns it into something larger than yourself. And it actually becomes what you want it to be about, which is a collective experience, you know?
Now, Atlanta, we get the sense overseas that Atlanta is the hottest music and cultural capital of the US. Like New York and Los Angeles have shifted, and a lot of the most interesting things to come out in the last decade belong or have some connection to Atlanta. I mean, even Kanye West was born in Atlanta, but is this perception shared amongst the Atlantans, or when you're living there, you don't really feel the buzz?
Oh man, I think that's pretty accurate now, you know. Like Atlanta has been a burgeoning creative center for years, for decades, but like for some reason the rest of the world caught on in the past 10 years, you know. But it's definitely been that for a while. It's like it's the home of trap music, which is all you hear anywhere in the world you go now. But you know, we've had what's called trap music since like 95, you know. And it's interesting, that's just how things work, you know. You don't necessarily think about it, but yeah, it's cool that Atlanta's so present and visible right now on the global scale. It's weird.
Is Atlanta a city that's more comfortable for an artist than say Brooklyn or Silver Lake in Los Angeles, which is apparently way less affordable to live in than 10 or 15 years ago, especially for the often precarious lifestyle of an artist?
I haven't lived in Atlanta since 2005.
Oh.
Yeah, I live in Brooklyn.
Algiers is doing good.
But no, it's just as expensive as New York. But it's expensive everywhere, man. Like,
yeah,
and you just have to find new ways of doing what you want to do. If you're creative, you know, it's never going to be easy. And it was never supposed to be easy in the first place. You know, like, I don't know, if you're an artist, you do it because you have a compulsion to do it, not because you're going to somehow live a comfortable life. That's certainly not the case for most, you know. But I don't know, you find ways of making it happen and you get on with it. You got to hustle. But you got to hustle, period, right?
Has the experience of making Shook ignited an interest in working as producers for others?
Yeah, I've always wanted to do that. All of us have, you know. And hopefully we'll be getting into that increasingly as time goes by. We'll have to see. But yeah, that's a really exciting prospect. I hope we're able to do that at some point more.
Are you looking forward to touring and playing this album live?
Yeah, you know, because whenever you start playing a song, new songs, you know, once you've recorded a song and it's on the record, like, it's only got like half of its soul. And it gets the other half as you start playing it, and there's a logic that grows out of it, and you understand the song better. And that only comes after touring it, you know, after playing it every night. Being in different moods when you engage and seeing how it wants to like kind of come to life on its own. And it's going to be very interesting with this record, because our entire stage show is going to be different. We're going to have virtual representations of our guests on stage with like different screens and so forth. There are going to be a lot of visuals, you know, and depending on where we are, we'll be playing shows with some of the guests on the record. We'll be playing shows with other people who aren't on the record but occupy the same space as the guests. And so it's going to be this constantly sort of evolving and changing fluid organism every show, you know, almost. It's going to be interesting.
That's beautiful. Well, I hope Barcelona's on your tour schedule. Thank you, Franklin.
Really thoughtful questions. Thanks, man.
Oh, thank you for saying that. It's been a pleasure, man. Goodbye.
You're listening to Radio Primavera Sound, proudly presented by Cupra.